Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature murder, espionage, and two of the greatest writers of the 20th century, Harper Lee and Boris Pasternak, from the Portland Book Festival in 2019. And no, unfortunately, this is not a conversation by these two writers, but it's the next best thing. This is a conversation between Casey Sepp and Laura Prescott, who bring us fresh insight into the enduring relevance of these iconic writers, discuss the political ramifications of their work at the time of publication, and reflect on what their work means today. Okay, now here's the backstory. In the 1970s, Harper Lee traveled back to her native Alabama with the idea of writing her own In Cold Blood. It was a project she would never actually write, but in Furious Hours, Casey Sepp brings this story to life, from the murders to the courtroom drama to the racial politics of the Deep South. At the same time, she offers a moving portrait of one of the country's most beloved writers in her struggle with fame, success, and the mystery of artistic creativity. Laura Prescott's The Secrets We Kept is a tale of secretaries turned spies, of love and duty, and of sacrifice, inspired by the true story of the CIA plot to infiltrate the hearts and minds of Soviet Russia, not with propaganda, but with the greatest love story of the 20th century, the novel Dr. Zhivago. Here's our moderator, Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review.
So both of you are debut authors, and this is a rarity, also New York Times best-selling authors with your first book. I'm curious for each of you, was this the book that you always planned to write? Did you know this was going to be your first book, or was there some other book that didn't happen?
I'll go first. Thanks for having me, everyone. I love Portland, so it's been great to be here. No, I have another book that's in the drawer. When I was working in political campaigns as an operative, but that just meant, you know, I was writing stump speeches and ad copy for political candidates. And I quit that job to pursue fiction because I was miserable in Washington, D.C. And I didn't know how to begin. I didn't have an MFA. I never studied creative writing. So I just started by saying, I'm going to write this novel. And so there's a novel in the drawer about an outsider artist named Helen Martins, who lived in South Africa, and I'm still obsessed with. But that kind of taught me how to write the next novel. So this novel kind of came as a surprise to me.
Will she come back?
I maybe. Not for the next one, but maybe the third one. All but right. I still have, she created this, her house into a work of art, and it was called the Owl House. I still have her owls in my office as like kind of a inspiration.
This was certainly the first project that kind of took the form of a book, but I guess if you had asked me as a child or even when I was first starting out writing what I thought my first book would be about, I probably would have said The Eastern Shore of Maryland. And that's, of course, you know, Pamela Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, knows an idea when she hears one versus a setting. And that's to say, I never had a book in mind, but I'm very interested in regionalism and really like the idea of place and like to think about how it shapes us. And so I feel like I got to do some of that in Furious Hours. It's not the place where I grew up, but this book is very much about Alabama and how people who live there make sense of their lives. And so I got to scratch that itch. But I think if you'd asked me, I would have thought my first book would be like about fishermen on the Eastern Shore or about the ecology of the Chesapeake Bay. And I hope to still write about that place someday. But I guess, like Laura, I feel like I learned a lot by writing about something that wasn't my primary passion.
I mean, both of you wrote about places that you are not from. I mean, Washington, yes, you knew because you'd worked there, but obviously not Russia. You traveled there as part of your research.
I did. So yeah, I lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for about a decade. And I just, in my mind, I know how to get from Georgetown to the East Street complex where the CIA was. And I just know that city by heart. I've walked it so many times, but I don't know Russia. And so during my first draft, I traveled there during my spring break of my MFA, as one does. And it was just an amazing experience to visit Moscow, but then also go to Perodelkino, where Boris Pasternak lived, and visit his grave and just see his house, which is kept as a museum, and you know, the snow coming down, and just having that atmospheric experience really solidified itself in my heart. So when I came back, I can kind of see, like, I know what the birch trees smelled like. I know what the snow felt like.
How far into the writing and research process did you go there? And did it change sort of what you were doing?
That was about 6 months into the writing process. I started with the Washington, D.C. story, so the CIA story of my book, and then quickly I realized I was missing half the story. If I wanted to tell the story of why Dr. Zhivago was used as a weapon during the Cold War, I couldn't just tell about the CIA agents that used it as a weapon. I wanted to show why it was so subversive. And so I knew it had to have an Eastern thread to the novel. And I quickly began researching Olga Ivinskaya, who was Boris Pasternak's real-life mistress and muse, and the inspiration for Lara and Dr. Zhivago, who I was named after. So she quickly became my next muse. And that's why when I went there, it definitely kind of changed the trajectory of how much of that story is going to be in the book.
And did you start your book from the Eastern Shore of Maryland and then at some point travel down to Alabama?
So my book grew out of some reporting I did in 2015 when Ghost at a Watchman was announced. So for years, Harper Lee had said she was never going to publish a book after To Kill a Mockingbird. But in 2015, HarperCollins made this shocking announcement that this new book would be coming out. And I went down to Monroeville, where Harper Lee was born and raised, and where she was at that time living in an assisted living facility. And I went down to do some reporting. And I was down there for about 2.5 weeks. And the book is actually about not Ghost at a Watchman, but a different project that Harper Lee got interested in the 70s and 80s. And that takes place in a town in Alabama called Alexander City. So I spent a lot of time in Alex City and went to Montgomery and went to Birmingham. And so I had a lot of ongoing reporting, but my original trip was to Monroeville to see that town. And I think she's an interesting example, and it's fascinating to hear Laura talk about the things she needed to experience for herself, because you know, To Kill a Mockingbird is not memoir, but it is very autobiographical fiction. And I think for me, one of the fascinating things to think about over and over again was the ways in which novelists or poets take the world that exists and make it their own. Because it's true, one of the reasons I took that assignment was I loved Mockingbird and I wanted to go see this town that was the model for Macomb. And it's surreal. You get out of your car and you look up at the courthouse and it's exactly like the one in the film that Gregory Peck was in. And you walk around the courthouse square and you can go and see the street that Harper Lee grew up on, you know, where Truman Capote was living right next door across a stone fence. And it's uncanny, and yet it's also not the novel. You know, there's so much that never took place in that town. And moreover, so many things that thousands of other people experienced over and over again that they never shaped into a story quite as beautiful as Mockingbird. So it was a pleasure to be there, and I did spend a lot more time in these other parts of the state over the years that I was reporting. But I did some from home. You know, you can do interviews from home, and you can read a lot. A lot of my book is history, and, you know, I didn't have to be in Alabama or Hartford to be reading about the history of life insurance. You know, you can pick up an academic volume and take it with you. And, you know, sometimes if you're really lucky, you can take your work, you know, to a beach or something, and you can learn just as well there. So some of it was just archival and academic work, but quite a lot of it was being there. And to Laura's point, those evocative details, you never know how useful they'll be and how you'll use them and what texture they'll bring to the story.
So I think it's pretty clear the two real common threads between these two books. One, the research, and I want to talk more about the research that each of you did, but also the fact that in different ways you are each writing about real writers, real books, and not unknown ones, you know, ones that people have a lot of thoughts and feelings about, and much has been written about them. And did that, you know, intimidate you going in? Did you think of, you know, did that concern you?
Yes. I think when I was first starting to write this novel, it was almost, it took me months and months before I said, yes, I am writing a novel. It was always the project and just trying to explore this little bit of history that had come out, because everyone has some sort of, they know what Dr. Zhivago is. They've either seen the David Lean film or they've read the book. So it's just like in the zeitgeist. And the thing that people didn't know is in 2014, the CIA released all of their documents detailing how they used this book as a weapon. And that's what kind of prompted me into writing the book in the first place, because I was so obsessed with propaganda, having been almost a propagandist myself, working in political campaigns, that I really wanted
like
to explore
political
this.
Operative.
I know. As an operative.
She's really wearing the
yes.
labels.
I said fiction writing is my penance for writing all those political ads, so, you know. But I did feel like, I feel like I asked some of my mentors, I was in my MFA program, and I was like, I don't know if like I can pull this off or if I have the right to. And a really amazing writer, Elizabeth McCracken, who's here at the festival, she said, you know, you can do what you want. Just do it from your heart and do what you're passionate about. And so I held close to that.
Did that feeling of you know, not having the right to write about this, did you have that same concern?
Because
this was Harper Lee's story that she never
told.
Oh, yeah,
sure. And I mean, Harper Lee is interesting because it's kind of one of these perverse ironies. It's like monks who want to live in poverty but then get quite wealthy. You know, Harper Lee wanted to live in obscurity, but it only made her more famous. So one of the initial challenges of this book was figuring out, you know, on the one hand, everyone knew something about her, and on the other hand, very little was known deeply about her. And the people who knew the most about her were the ones who had never shared their stories or talked about her publicly. So I felt like there was this peculiar problem of everyone thinking they knew something about her, but most of what they knew was wrong, and that included me. So the challenge was to figure out how to learn as much and as accurately as I could. But Pamela's asking about this other problem, as it were, which is my book is about this book Harper Lee failed to write. And you better believe over and over again, I wondered if I could do it because she hadn't been able to. And it seemed like, you know, there were very good structural reasons particular to the story that made it hard for her to complete her project. And then, of course, it turned out there were all of these personal reasons that had to do with her relationship to writing and her relationship to the world. And in that sense, it felt like, okay, I don't struggle with those things. These are not my burdens. You know, she was a perfectionist, and she suffered from depression, and she had a drinking problem, and there were a constellation of things that made it difficult for her to do any work, not just this particular project. And I feel very lucky not to have those same needs or concerns, and to have a support system that, you know, she didn't. So there were things about it that worried me, but no, ongoingly it felt like at the end of the day I was just writing such a different book, which was a book that had her in it. And to the point of her pathological privacy, she would never have given you the, you know, kind of Nancy Drew version of Harper Lee, you know, true crime reporter. So there was always a space for me and my book that would be quite distinct from the one that she was trying to write.
You said that your idea that you had of Harper Lee, like many people's idea, that your idea of her was wrong. Like, what did you learn about her that surprised you?
Sure. I mean, I think that the unfortunate word that got attached to Harper Lee long about 1964 was recluse. And it's a very perverse word. It rarely applies to the people on whom it is placed. And in her case, you know, not wanting to talk to the New York Times did not mean she didn't want to talk to anyone.
It didn't?
She was, I know.
I'm
exactly.
Insulted.
Shocking. You don't want to talk to the press. You actually do want to talk to people. And so I think when I say I was wrong, you know, I feel like one of the first things someone told me about Harper Lee's time in this town, Alex City. So she moves to this town for 9 months, and she's basically trying to do what she helped Capote do out in Kansas. She's trying to gather enough material for a narrative nonfiction project. And one of the first stories somebody told me about her time in this town was they met her at the grocery store. She introduced herself, first of all, which was shocking. And then she agreed to come for pimento cheese sandwiches for lunch. And then she signed a copy of Mockingbird for the woman's children. And right away, I thought, that's not a recluse, mm-hmm. right? You know, that's not, she has opened herself up to conversation, and she's sociable, and she wanted to talk about the history of the lake where this had happened. And so right away, it was just clear she was not reclusive, and also that she was ambitious in a way that I think even, you know, I loved Mockingbird, but I think I had underestimated her as a writer, that this was a very ambitious project she'd undertaken. And so I felt like over and over again, she surprised me.
So we associate Harper Lee with, obviously, To Kill a Mockingbird, maybe to a lesser extent with Ghost at a Watchman, but the story that you write about is a real story, a real nonfiction story that is less well-known. Laura, same with you. You're writing about a nonfiction story. Since most people here probably are familiar with Dr. Zhivago, what is the story of what happened with the CIA and Dr. Zhivago?
Yeah, so Boris Pasternak, just to put it into some context, he was one of the most famous Soviet writers of his time, and he was famous for being a poet, first and foremost. And he was so famous, he would sell out these huge packed auditoriums. And when he was reading his poetry, people would start to shout out the lines before he could finish them.
And what was the time period that you're talking about?
So Boris, well, so it was 1956 when he finished Dr. Zhivago, mm-hmm. which was his first and only novel. And when he finished it, you know, on and off during the time it took him to write the book, he kept saying, you know, it's never going to be published, to maybe there's some hope after Stalin died in 1953 that there could be a thaw that could allow his book. But when he sent it off to the state publishers, which was what you had to do to get approval to be published, it was just crickets. He didn't hear anything back. And this is a most famous living writer at the time in the area. And he just knew that this was not going to be published. And lo and behold, during this time when the Soviets are pretty much going to ban the book, the Italians show up at his doorstep, his literal doorstep in the country home he lived in, about 20 miles outside of Moscow. And Feltrinelli, who was the Italian publisher, the first to bring Dr. Zhivago to the world, had a scout that lived in Moscow, and he took the book and he smuggled it out of the Soviet Union into East Berlin, into West Berlin, and met up with Feltrinelli. And once the Soviets heard that the Italians had this book, they're like, you have to give it back to us. They were pressuring, and Feltrinelli and Pasternak both held strong. And so the Italians published it in 1957. It was a huge worldwide sensation, number one New York Times bestseller, knocking Lolita off the top of the charts. And much to Nabokov's chagrin, he hated Dr. Zhivago, and very much so. And the CIA sees this, and they sense an opportunity, and they had what they called their books program. And they said, we're gonna take this banned book of the Soviets' most famous living writer, and we're gonna print it in its native Russian and smuggle it back behind the Iron Curtain for the Soviets to read and question why their government banned this book from them. And that's what they did. And it was quite a success for them.
And so for those here who have not read Dr. Zhivago, what was it that so terrified the Soviet regime about this novel?
Yeah, so many people think of Dr. Zhivago as just a love story. If they've seen the David Lean film, which is amazing, but it's also a war story. And it's also, what makes it actually the most subversive isn't that it's critical of the Russian Revolution, it's that different individuals throughout the book have different opinions about the Russian Revolution, and they've been affected by it. Some have prospered because of it, some have, you know, been downgraded because of it, but everyone has their own opinion, which is flying in the face of the collective thought. And it talks about groupthink and how dangerous it can be. And even if it's not, you know, these people giving speeches about how detrimental the revolution was, it's just that they had the opinion in the first place that made it subversive.
Okay, I'm not going to get you to reveal the entire plot of your novel. That said, sticking again to the real story, how did they get the novel into the Soviet Union?
Oh, so yes, through various ways. And one of the first ways is that they use the World's Fair in Brussels in 1958 as a staging ground to smuggle these printed novels back behind the Iron Curtain. And they used the Vatican's pavilion. They partnered up with the Vatican, which actually the CIA did often, and posed as clergy within the Vatican's pavilion. And
this is like a Dan Brown novel.
Is actually true. I know, when I was reading these memos, I was like, this is stranger than fiction. How am I gonna pull off writing this? No one's gonna believe it. they're posing. So they would identify Soviet visitors because Soviets couldn't travel as often as they could. But since this World's Fair was a staging ground, they had this giant pavilion. There were, you know, members of the Bolshoi Ballet and the symphony that attended. They would identify them coming into the Vatican Pavilion and escort them behind into a secret chapel where they would give them a copy of Dr. Zhivago. And soon, like, they were these blue linen covered copies of Zhivago, and soon all of the blue linen covers were ripped off and spread throughout the fair because they were taking the covers off and ripping it into pieces so they can better conceal it. And sure enough, a few of them made it back into the Soviet Union and immediately went into the underground world of samizdat, of people copying it and, you know, in their typewriters and basements and kitchens, and then started spreading it because everyone wanted to read it. So, yeah.
Just as good a story, perhaps, yeah. as in the novel. Casey, To Kill a Mockingbird is obviously a great story, but this other story, I have to say, it's insane. I mean, tell us the story about the true story about The Reverend, the book that Harper Lee wanted
Must
to write.
Must be said, this is a bad panel for clergy. I think they're just, you know, undercover CIA agents.
Some of them are.
in my book, I mean, it must be said, a childhood preacher of mine, you know, said I wasn't doing any favors for the ministry with this book. So the serial killer at the heart of the story is a Baptist minister who was not able to do that full-time for a living. He had a number of other jobs, too, and you know, he was an itinerant preacher, but he also worked for a textile mill, and he served in the army, and that textile mill is actually the one that made his uniform. And when he came back to Alabama, he went to work for the mill, and he worked at a rock quarry, and he also worked in the timber industry in Alabama. He did what's called pulpwooding, which, you know, I know I'm in timber country up here. It might surprise you to learn how much of it is based in the Southeast, too. But, you know, this was an African-American man who was incredibly ambitious and very intelligent, but who had limited opportunities when he returned to Alabama. And he was married for about 25 years and was known simply as the Reverend Willie Maxwell. But that far into a marriage, his wife was then found murdered. And he was the prime suspect, and the police thought they were going to convict him of the murder. They had a neighbor of his who was supposed to testify that he had been out all night, and in fact, he had lured his wife to the very place where her body was found. But that woman changed her testimony, that neighbor did, and the police were confused until she became the second Mrs. Maxwell. And so that was why she had changed her testimony, and then she was found dead under similarly suspicious circumstances. And then a nephew, a brother, and then finally a 16-year-old stepdaughter of this reverend were all found dead. And the thread through this plot is that the reverend held life insurance policies on all these individuals. So he made about $500,000 in life insurance money. And Harper Lee did not come to know his story until 1977, when he was gunned down at the funeral of his last alleged victim. And that's when Harper Lee found out about this story, because a vigilante stood up at the funeral of that 16-year-old and murdered the reverend in cold blood. And that's when, to Pamela's point, you know, this story was one lived out in fear and terror in this small town, mostly because people didn't know who all the reverend had life insurance policies on and how he was getting away with things. And actually, I interviewed a guy who employed the reverend when he was doing this pulpwooding business for timbering. And that guy said to me, you know, I always used to tell a joke about the reverend when people would ask me if I was afraid of him. And I said, you know, really? What was the joke? And he said, I had insurance on him. Which was true, because you have to insure your employees and that kind of work. And so when the Reverend was gunned down, that vigilante's trial was a kind of sensation in Alabama. And that's when Harper Lee found out about it and came down and tried to turn not only the original criminal story and the life insurance fraud and this kind of stuff into a story, but the Reverend's lawyer. So the lawyer who had defended the Reverend for 10 years, not only in these criminal investigations, but in a lot of civil litigation too, because you can believe if the police were upset about the Reverend Willie Maxwell, the life insurance companies were even more upset, and had tried to stop payment, and the Reverend ended up having to take many of them to court. So his lawyer then defended the vigilante who murdered him. And so Harper Lee found another complicated lawyer, not unlike the Atticus Finch of Go Set a Watchman. So that's the story that drew her to this part of Alabama. But she was trying to turn it into a book like In Cold Blood. She was not initially trying to write a novel, much like Boris Pasternak. She was at a point in her career where she was trying to do something new. So what she did in the time she was in this town was the same kind of investigative reporting that I did to write a nonfiction book about it. She gathered documents, she sat in on the trial of the vigilantes, she interviewed the lawyers, the coroners, folks who had known the victims of the Reverend's murders, and people who worked for the insurance companies, and just gathered a tremendous amount of material to turn into a nonfiction book.
There's so much in there that one needs to follow up on, and a lot of it is obviously in your book. But among the many shocking things about this is that, as we know from To Kill a Mockingbird and our history, it was awfully easy to convict a black man of murder, of any crime, especially in Alabama at that time. And whether he had done the crime or committed the crime or not. And this is a case where you have an African-American man who did commit the crime and yet got off.
Several times over, yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the curiosities. If you've read Ghost at a Watchman, and out of curiosity, I'm going to assume most of the people in this room have read Mockingbird, but how many of y'all have read Ghost at a Watchman? Okay. So, you know...
Actually, can we ask how many have read To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
There you go.
And how many have read Dr. Zhivago? Okay.
This is just actually, you guys, you're not a good sample
highly
size.
Educated
you're
audience.
I won't ask you how many have read their books, because I'm sure after this panel, it will be everyone very soon.
Well, in any event, even if you didn't read Ghost at a Watchman, you probably learned from the coverage, you know, at the Times and everywhere else, that Watchman was a much more politically ambitious and a much more morally complicated version of the Mockingbird story. And the character of Atticus Finch had absolutely, you know, disastrous politics for the grown-up Scout to encounter and make sense of. And Scout has gone to live in New York, you know, in this incredibly integrated society. And she's come home as an adult to Alabama, and she's trying to make sense of, you know, the mandate to integrate and her father's resistance and the kind of genteel racism of the White Citizens Council. And that is all to say that Harper Lee in the 1970s, when she found out about the Reverend Willie Maxwell, was looking for a complicated story about race. And that's why I think one of the things that was interesting to her was this asymmetry between the experience of the Reverend, who was never convicted of any of these murders and who prevailed in more than a dozen civil cases, and the case of the vigilante, because if you can believe it, the same lawyer who got the Reverend off managed to get the vigilante off too. So you are talking about two black defendants who got away with murder. And it's certainly the way that it's still talked about in these communities, and it is one of the peculiarities of this case. And there are very specific things to talk about when you talk about the jury pools that were involved, about the lawyer who represented these two men. And so I think that complexity, though, and that surprise is part of what attracted her to it, because she did not want to continue to be the author of Mockingbird, this kind of, you know, moral imperative for the culture. And she had lived for a long time as the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, as the civil rights hero, which was not a comfortable mantle for her to wear. And so I think one of the things she was trying to do was remodel herself, not as a kind of, you know, she had been pejoratively painted into this corner of children's book author. And I think what she wanted to say is, no, I am Harper Lee, the writer. And I am Harper Lee, who has a complicated story to say about race in America and race in the American South.
So Flannery O'Connor, who it might be said was probably jealous of Harper.
She's the Nabokov to,
yeah,
to Harper Lee.
She
as Boris
famously gave To Kill a Mockingbird very, I can't remember if she reviewed it in the Times Book Review, it's possible, but she did not have nice things to say about it and essentially wrote it off as a children's book. And I'm curious, since you've mentioned that, is that how Harper Lee thought of her book?
No, not at all. I mean, I think not surprisingly, you know, any novelist who writes about children will tell you having child characters does not make necessarily for childish fiction. And so I think she was grateful for the amount of attention the book had, and she interacted quite lovingly with children who would write to her about reading the book in school, or when adults would write to her to say that reading that book as a teenager, you know, made me into a reader or made me into a writer, or even more satisfyingly, made me into the kind of person who looks for difference and diversity in the world. But she did not set out to write a children's book.
I mean, for the record, the way that most of us in the book world sort of think about what makes a book about children a children's book versus what makes a book about children an adult book is perspective. And it's whether you're fully immersed in it, if you're fully immersed in the voice and perspective of that character, that child character, then it's a children's book. But if there is some distance, then it's an adult book, which by that definition, To Kill a Mockingbird is an adult book. But what she did so effectively was inhabit the mind of that child right. during those parts that I think maybe confused people in terms of the
yeah,
the definition.
I think, you know, God bless Flannery O'Connor, but I think, you know, there was just a bit of professional jealousy. I don't think Flannery O'Connor got anywhere near the New York Times bestseller list, and Harper Lee sat on it for a year, and then the film came out, and she sat on it for another year, and, you know, then over and over again, she's just returned to it. It's kind of fun for me. In the years I was working on my book, I had what probably a lot of nonfiction writers in the room have, which is a Google alert for the subject of my book. And in the case of Willie Maxwell, there's a rapper named Fetty Wap whose legal name is Willie Maxwell. And I can't tell you the number of times Fetty Wap got arrested when I was working on my book. But Harper Lee, you see her pop back onto the bestseller list every fall and every spring because it's those, you know, she's on every syllabus. And, you know, again, I don't know that she would have put herself on the syllabus for 7th and 8th graders. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she would have said, if you're giving it to children to read, you're probably underestimating the sophistication of the story.
When you, I think she's right. When you are talking about Harper Lee and her approach to the reverend and sort of her interest in it, you're sort of saying, well, I think she thought, and I think she, how did you get into her mind? Did she keep a diary? Were there letters? Like, how were you able to trace her relationship to this?
Sure. I'm probably going to get my comeuppance being on this panel with Laura, because I've always nursed this thought that if I had simply been writing a novel, it would have been easier. You know, you could just project and come up with conjecture. And one of the interesting things about Harper Lee and nonfiction, both about this book she was trying to write and about In Cold Blood, this book that she had helped Capote put together, is she had very conservative ideas about nonfiction and fiction and the difference between the two, and was very disapproving of the way that, you know, the culture has moved towards a kind of the kinds of liberties that nonfiction writers sometimes take. And I don't mean fake news. I mean in the sense that nonfiction writers often inhabit a perspective they can't possibly have access to. And they are willing to give psychological projection or to fill out details or to embellish a scene to make it more literary. And that's a thing I have in common with Harper Lee. I'm pretty conservative about it. So the truth of the matter is, if it's in the book and I tell you it's something she thought, it's because I have a letter where she said it. Or I interviewed somebody and she said it to them. There's very little in the way of projection, and I tried over and over again to be very responsible, because I think she's right about true crime being a genre where those kinds of liberties are particularly transgressive. They are often on the part of marginal communities, or they are on the part of victims and deceased individuals who will have no recourse for the misunderstandings that are put forward on their behalf. So I think it's a way she and I have something in common, and I tried to honor that over and over again in the book. And the truth is, it's not just a problem for Harper Lee. Everybody in the book was dead by the time I found the story, for the most part.
Right. I mean, she set herself up a kind of tall order to model it after In Cold Blood, because Truman Capote, of course, had a distinct advantage.
He had access to the two killers, but I'll tell you, I mean, I quote some letters in the book where Harper Lee is very disapproving of In Cold Blood. And the thing to know about it is she didn't just help in the sense of she went out once. You know, if you've seen Capote or Infamous, you know that she accompanied Capote. He actually disparagingly called her his assistant researchist, was the kind title he gave her. And he said condescendingly once to George Plimpton that, you know, she had just been helpful with the wives, as if the wives weren't characters in their own right, or, you know, to Laura's beautiful book that women have these incredible intellectual lives of their own. But she was very disapproving because she went back several times with Capote, and she was with him for the reporting, and she knew what people had said, and she knew the position they had on the murders and the victims. And over again in the book, she could see the fabrications that he added to the story and the embellishments that he added to the story. And over again, the kind of ethical posture he took towards a story that was supposed to be about this murdered family and became a kind of apologia for the two men who had murdered them. Probably for good reason, we might say. You know, he was anti-death penalty, and he was using the book to make an argument about capital punishment and the way the judicial system works, but Harper Lee was very disapproving. So in some ways, her book was the anti-Inkle Blood. What she wanted to do was hew closely as possible to the facts. And she went around telling people, you know, she was doing old-fashioned journalism and straight-laced journalism, and she was kind of self-important about it. And, you know, I think it's important, though, to give Capote a little bit of his due, which is to say he finished his book and she didn't. That's a very high standard to live up to. And,
yes.
You know, at the end of the day, you'll see some creative solutions on my part and on the part of other writers who dig into stories where you can't know the whole truth, which is frankly every story. You know, you meet the margins of what you can know in every story you try to tell.
Well, both your books are in some ways another common thread is that they are about work by women that didn't go recognized. And Laura, that's particularly true in both of the stories, the Eastern story and the Western story of your book. Was that something you deliberately set out to kind of redress?
No, actually, it wasn't. The first voice that came to me was this voice of the CIA typist, because I had been reading all of these declassified memos and thinking about the women, because it was a group of women who were the typists that had typed the reports and typed the memos and knew all of the redacted content and the secrets of the secret keepers. And it just kind of made my mind travel down this part of the CIA, that who were these women that worked in the early CIA, and which led me to research early women spies and these women who fought in World War II in the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. But as soon as the war was over, they were put behind a desk, and that's the level that they could reach. So it wasn't that I set out to tell the story, it just, it kind of found me in that way. And same thing with the Eastern story. I had been researching so much about Boris Pasternak. There's just dozens and dozens and dozens of books written about Boris, but I started focusing behind him of Olga when I read her autobiography, when she told her own story of everything she went through to help protect Boris and to help Dr. Zhivago get out into the world, including, you know, they punished Boris by sentencing her to the gulag. And she was sentenced to 5 years. Stalin dies, so she gets out in 3, but she goes right back to Boris. And all the while, Boris has never left his wife. And the mistress lived a 20-minute walk from his house. And he had the best of both worlds. And I knew for some reason I wanted to focus on her and tell this part of the story from that angle. But it was all about telling history from different angles and different perspectives.
You mentioned early on that you were named after the character in Dr. Zhivago. So I imagine you have a very kind of close connection to that novel. I mean, your parents both were big fans. Like, were you read it in the crib? Like, how did your... That's right.
Yes. No, so, yeah, my mother... I think my mother was the one that pushed for Laura, for me to be named Laura, and I always knew that that's where my name came from. And David Lean's film was always on, especially during, like, the holiday season. They somehow play it because of the snow, I guess, even though it's not a Christmas
movie. It was like
movie.
The Wizard of Oz in your
yeah,
family.
Exactly. We always had it on, but it wasn't until I was in high school, I mean, that I actually picked up Boris Pasternak's novel, and I was in my Russian phase, and I was reading, you know, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and I was like, finally, I'm going to read Zhivago. And I did have an immediate connection to the novel. And it's been one of these novels that I've read every few years and gotten something different every single time I've read it. Then as a teenage girl, 15 years old, I really was like, I want to know about this love story. I want Laura and Yuri. I want to see the love story. When I was working in Washington, D.C. in campaigns, I was interested in what made this book a banned book. What was subversive about this book politically? And then, you know, when I quit my job in Washington to take on fiction, I looked at Boris Pasternak's sentences on this, like, poetic level and started appreciating him as just the fine writer that he was. So it's something that's, like, always been part of my life, and reading this old copy of Zhivago over and over again. And that said, I never thought I would write a novel about it until I heard the CIA story, but it just all kind of made sense.
Did you pick the novel up again after you'd done all this research and written your book? And
yes.
How did it read then?
Yes, I read it. I read it again. I think it was after my third draft, and I was just, I actually was going through it and highlighting everything that I think got it banned, and it was an interesting exercise. And also, because I always would highlight, you know, these beautiful sentences, but I wanted to highlight the sentences that got this novel banned, and it just show me so much more about the courage it took for him to give his novel to the world, because it could have meant certain death to him. He certainly saw many of his peers murdered or disappeared or sentenced to the gulag during his lifetime, and yet he wanted to get his book in the world. And so I was just, you know, quite taken by that aspect of it when the final time I've read it. And I'm sure I'll read it again. I have a goal of learning Russian to enough that I can read Dr. Zhivago in the way that it's meant to be read in Russian.
There's another point that your two books have in common, which is To Kill a Mockingbird has also been banned off and on because of its depictions of race. And I'm curious, do you recall your first time reading it, and what was your reaction to it?
I do. I should say, though, on the subject of censorship and Mockingbird, it's a very interesting example of, you know, if you live long enough, you see everything. And Mockingbird has been banned for very different reasons over the years. So initially, the response, the attempt to ban it was, you know, from within conservative places, there was this sense, and Harper Lee got a lot of nasty letters about betraying her race and betraying the place she was from. And so there was this sense that it was transgressive, that it would promote equality and integration, and so it was not well received in those circles. And then over the years, there were concerns about the depiction of sexual violence. So obviously, at the heart of Mockingbird is a story about the accusation of rape, and about incest. You know, what has actually happened to Mayella Yule is that her father has taken advantage of her. So it's a false rape accusation in the sense that Tom Robinson is not the one who committed this act of sexual violence, but this is a girl who's being abused. And so there were challenges about the age appropriateness of that rape story. And now, actually, I think there are very reasonable concerns about the role the novel plays in our cultural discourse on race. And probably there are better books to be teaching our children in the seventh or eighth grade. And so I hesitate to say that the book is banned, because I think now there are very sophisticated and meaningful conversations happening about what are the best books. You know, we have to make choices about the limited amount of time we have in our classrooms. And so people, for instance, who want there to be, you know, diverse voices on a syllabus, or for children of diverse backgrounds to be able to encounter not just peripheral characters, but narrators who represent their race or their ethnicity. You know, Mockingbird is not a book that does that well. It does a lot of things well, and it's a beautiful book, but I don't think it's fair to say that a lot of the folks who are talking about where Mockingbird should be in our syllabuses today are out to have it banned.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a trickier, more complicated kind of publishing history, as it were, and I think Harper Lee was aware of that. You know, she got letters over the years about various reasons people did or didn't want to teach it. And, you know, I think now what's happening with Mockingbird is it's a little bit like Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's moving up the kind of scholastic experience. So you might be reading it now as an undergraduate in a survey of American literature, or in a graduate course on, you know, the history of, you know, democratic politics or something like that. And so it's not being banned. You know, to say that we shouldn't teach it to seventh graders doesn't mean no one should read it. And I think it will always have a place in our culture, and partly because of the experience I had as a kid with it. So to answer your question, you know, I read it as a bookish tomboy who was a total daddy's girl and found in Scout a character who seemed a lot like me. My dad wasn't a lawyer, but I worshipped him. And, you know, I didn't have a best friend like Truman Capote, who's the model for Dill. But, you know, I had interesting and intellectual friends, and we felt set apart partly from a lot of the people we knew. And I felt like the place where I had grown up, this kind of rural place, suddenly had, you know, a place in literature that wasn't unlike some of the bigger important novels that people read. So, you know, I think we read these books. Look, Pamela, you could say more about this probably than we could. You know, what is it about a book as a child that seizes you? And for me, Mockingbird was Scout. It was a narrator who seemed an awful lot like me.
I think that's probably true of all of us, and those books that stick to us from a young age. Now, another book, obviously, that had a very complicated history, publishing history, is Ghost at a Watchman, And now having...
So how much time do we have left?
Yes. I do want to say that we will have time for questions, so start thinking about the questions you want to ask. We'll break for questions soon. But I do want to hear your take on Ghosts at a Watchman, both in terms of it as a novel, but also if you have your own sort of theories, having some insight now into Harper Lee as to, you know, was this a draft of To Kill a Mockingbird? Do you think she actually intended for it ever to see the light of day?
Yeah, it's interesting hearing Laura, you know, be able to tell you exactly what she did between certain drafts of her novel. Because one of the most interesting things about Harper Lee's life at the time when she was first setting down the Makeham story, so 1957 really is when she got Ghost at a Watchman shaped into a book. And it was the first version of the Makeham story she told. Mockingbird was it's not quite fair to say it was a revision, but it took that story and reshaped it. And over a period of 2.5 years, Harper Lee worked with this incredible editor. It's so funny to think about her story being the untold one in my book, because I actually think this woman, Tay Ho Hoff, this extraordinary editor at Lippincott Publishing House, is really one of the unsung heroes of American literary history. She's up there with Maxwell Perkins. She took a writer who had never taken a creative writing course and helped her make a better book. And it was a very slow, deliberate process, you know, chapter by chapter, page by page, figuring out the problems of perspective or the way the setting should be constricted or expanded, and making sense of a kind of, you know, aesthetic and political decision about what was going to go on in the novel. So Harper Lee had this vision of the world and the story she wanted to tell, but it was only thanks to this editor, Tay Ho Hoff, that she figured out how to do it. So I don't think there's anything mysterious about Watchmen. It is the very first version of the book she delivered to her agents who tried to sell it and no one wanted to publish it. Familiar experience maybe to some of the writers in the room. She walked into her agents and they were enthusiastic and they liked the characters, but nowhere they sent it was interested. Tay Ho Hoff read Ghost at a Watchman and said, I don't want to publish this book, but I want to help you make a book we can publish. I like these characters. I like this story. I want to help you make it into a better book. And it took 2.5 years, but they made To Kill a Mockingbird. And that's the book that Lippincott ultimately published. And there's a little bit of material in the archives. You know, for a while they were going to call it Atticus, and there were these kinds of in-between periods where they didn't quite know what the book was, but at the end of the day, the easiest way to explain it is she walked in with Ghost at a Watchman, and 2.5 years later, the book that went to press was To Kill a Mockingbird.
What did you think of Ghost at a Watchman?
What did I think of it? It's interesting to see all those hands. I was absolutely fascinated by it. I think it is an incredibly interesting literary time capsule or artifact of a writer's process. So I'm sure, you know, at some point people will be reading your drafts and someone will want to know, you know, when did she decide, you know, she was going to actually have two parallel geographies going, or, you know, when did she change this detail or that? And it's rare that we really get to see that process for a writer. It's like The Wasteland, but you're looking at Pound's edits. You know, you can really see specific things that change and become better. And so I was grateful for the opportunity to see it. I think it's a little grievous that it was published as a sequel, and that the way that book was marketed was, you know, Harper Lee for decades and decades has slaved over the sequel to her beloved book, and now we present it to you. Because it's not that. You know, it's a very rough version of the story, and I think, you know, the first third is really great and the last two thirds are kind of rubbish. They're worth reading, they're fun, and again, they're interesting, but I don't think it should be taught, you know, anywhere that's not a kind of history of politics in this country, or even better, kind of MFA course of how does revision work, you know, what's the ideal relationship to an editor, how can we improve the ideas we have and make better books out of them.
All right, so I'm going to ask you one more question on Ghost at a Watchman, which you will disapprove of, and Harper Lee, I'm sure, will have disapproved on being very conservative about not, you know, psychologizing and offering too much conjecture into someone else's mind. But do you think that from what you learned reporting down in Makeham and what you learned about Harper Lee, that she wanted this to be published before she died?
You all seem really nice, so I hate to do this to you, but the thing I will say is, you know, keep looking for my byline in The New Yorker, because I'll have more to say about it.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So all I right. promise, I'm not a tease about the book. I'll tell you anything that's in it. I'll spoil every single plot there is, but yeah, unfortunately on that one I'm going to have to say, you know, keep if you are interested in that story and you're interested in her affairs, keep your eyes peeled.
Everyone subscribe now.
Exactly.
Yes. Laura, one final question for you, because Casey, you mentioned earlier about sort of wishing in a way that you know, you could have had the freedom of fiction to, did you...
You should summarily reject that. I'm sure it's much more difficult.
You knew that this was going to be a novel from the get-go. Did you find that, you know, in addition to all the research that you did and everything that's based in fact, that sort of having that freedom to make things up enabled you to flesh out this story in ways you wouldn't have been able to do in nonfiction?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And, you know, when you're half of my characters are purely fiction characters, and then there are real people that existed in the book, but even if I'm reading all the letters and all of the primary resources and firsthand accounts, part of me, like the novelist in me, really wanted to know, what does Olga say to Boris the moment after he wins the Nobel Prize? That's not recorded. And so the amazing thing about historical fiction is that you can go there and you can try to capture the essence of these real people, but at the same time, imagine what would they say to each other? How would they react? And I think within the real story of my novel, that's where I was most interested in. Trying to respect their legacy of who they were, but also, you know, what happens behind closed doors.
All right, I have many more questions, but I'm sure all of you have questions too, so I want to open it up to your questions. Just raise your hand. Someone has a microphone. All right up here in front.
Casey, this is for you. So when I read Watchmen, after 45, 50 years, I felt like I was hearing this voice again that I hadn't heard in all this time. So I was pretty darn sure that's Harper Lee. And in fact, I heard Scout, right? Which was such a joy. And yet, there were people that said it wasn't hers, right? And at the same time, there are people that think that maybe she wrote in cold blood. So why do you think that is? And what do you think of those conspiracy theories? And is it because it's a woman? Is it because she's described as a recluse? Is it just because she only had one novel that she published before this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's interesting, when I first started working on my book, I very often got asked if I thought Harper Lee actually wrote To Kill a Mockingbird or if I thought Truman Capote did. So that was the starting place. A lot of people nursed this, and you're right to call it a conspiracy theory. There was no evidence at all really for it, but there was the sense that the book was too good, and since she hadn't been able to do it again, and you know, she and Capote were friends, and he had experienced a lot of that life in Monroeville that she had, so he would have had the kind of fodder for it. And so the thought was, well, he must have written it. And then she went quiet because she never wanted anyone to know, and she could never admit that he had actually written it. I can tell you, Truman Capote kept no secrets. He would never have been able to keep the secret that he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller. You know, he could not keep secret, you know, the number of letters in his mailbox on any given day. So, and actually, if you are interested in that theory, there's a wonderful letter that the local museum in Monroeville has put up. Truman Capote is writing a letter to some of his family who lived in Monroeville, who knew Nell, and he's almost disgusted that she's written a book that's so good. He's writing to let them know he's just had a chance to read it. So it's one of the very straightforward source materials that suggests, you know, there is no evidence that he even saw it pre-publication. And right around the time she had delivered the revisions to Mockingbird, the like pre-press revisions, is when she went out to Kansas to help him with In Cold Blood. So it is interesting to me, this new question of, does she get enough credit for her work on In Cold Blood? And I think that's another, it's like the story of Tay Hohoff and Harper Lee, you know, the relationship between a writer and an editor. I think we don't have much language for the kinds of literary collaborations that happen all the time. You know, we talk to people about our work, we have friends, we have conversation partners who help make our work better. Sometimes even research assistants who collaborate on these things. And so because we have a kind of emaciated language for that, the only option is, well, should she have gotten a co-author credit or did she really write it? And if you go to the New York Public Library, which you can do, and you don't have to have a research project to motivate it, but you can go and see the 150 pages of notes that Lee made for Capote. You know, all of her records from the interviews, and they're wonderful. So when you talk about missing her voice, and I think you're absolutely right, it's clear she wrote Ghost at a Watchman. It's not as beautiful as To Kill a Mockingbird, but the voice is there, the texture is there, the writerly talent is there. It's unrefined.
And it gets better and tighter, and you know, she pulls the shoelaces together on Mockingbird in a way she didn't in Watchmen. But if you go and you look at those notes, they're fascinating, and she's giving Capote notes on the jury selection and on the legal appeals process, and you know, she's measuring the height of different mirrors and the number of pairs of socks in a drawer, and it's incredibly detailed. It was a real gift. But I think here is where, you know, Harper Lee struggled. She did not write in cold blood. And I say that because she could not write The Reverend, the book she was trying to write about the Reverend Willie Maxwell. And no amount of material, no amount of notes, no amount of research equals a book. And that is where Capote succeeded, and she couldn't with her story. I would draw a distinction between that kind of collaboration. And, you know, look, he co-dedicated In Cold Blood to her. The dedication is shared with his long-term partner, Jack Dunphy, and Harper Lee. So he acknowledged her. And it's probably fair to say he could have given her more credit. You know, it is not generous to call someone your assistant researchist, but I don't think it borders on, you know, is she a co-author? Did she secretly write it? Because, you know, the corresponding thing to notice about In Cold Blood is it's a very different style than the one she had. And again, when you think about those deeper structural decisions he was making about who deserves sympathy or who was a hero and how protagonists operate in the world, he's making the kinds of moral decisions that she rejected after To Kill a Mockingbird, meaning she did not want easy heroes. And what he did was craft Agent Dewey into an easy hero. You know, a lot of the KBI agents who had worked on that case were upset when the book came out because they felt his literary decisions about who had done what undermined the richness of the story and how it had actually unfolded in real time.
Do you think it tormented her that she was unable to write The Reverend? And you mentioned that she suffered from depression, and
I think there was a lot of torment in Harper Lee's life, and this book was one small part of it. And this book was one of many she tried to write and couldn't.
All right, unfortunately, we are out of time, but a round of applause, please, to these two very talented writers, both critically acclaimed and bestsellers out of the gate.
That was a conversation between Casey Sepp and Laura Prescott from the Portland Book Festival in November 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.